Welcome to Horror 101, a special series celebrating some of the most influential films from the horror genre. Tonight, John Kenneth Muir, an accomplished author and critic, and one of our favorite guests. You can check out his library of books on films of all genres at johnkennethmuir.com and read his enlightening criticism at reflectionsonfilmandtelevision.blogspot.com. When I think of the great horror films and the horror films that have affected me in my life, they all have the same quality in that they all go for broke. I mean, they no holds barred. They go to the extremes that other films would obviously be wary of. When I think of The Exorcist, and even today, I mean, the masturbation with a crucifix. I mean, it's incredibly shocking. And Chainsaw is just as immediate and frightening for me now as it was when I first watched it as a kid. I mean, do you find that's the primary characteristic of the great horror films?
I think the great horror films really do transgress. Now, there are many good horror films which just jolt, and it's this very pleasant experience of a roller coaster ride. Oh, a shock, another shock. I wasn't expecting that. But those aren't really the great horror movies. The great horror movies are the ones just like you mentioned, like The Exorcist or The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which really go for broke, which really leap across what we consider traditional Hollywood decorum and break a lot of taboos, and not just taboos in terms of what is happening on screen, but sort of the way it happens on screen, the way it is presented. I mean, if you look at some of the films we're talking about in this series, Psycho, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and The Blair Witch Project, they transgress in terms of how they're structured, not just what they show or depict. They, how they sort of use, co-opt, and subvert the idea of the three-act narrative, or the fact that in movies we expect to learn something, or in movies we expect to follow one particular lead character. You know, all these movies have found ways to subvert that very structure. And in a sense, that's more disturbing than anything else, especially when you do couple it with something like masturbating with a crucifix or, you know, someone coming after you with a chainsaw. Because as viewers, we are all accustomed to a lifetime of seeing sort of the same kind of thing. It's the three-act narrative structure. We're going to have our hero. We're going to have our villain. We have certain expectations. There are going to be bumps and bruises along the way in a horror movie, but in the end, it'll ultimately be okay, but then there'll be the hook for a sequel or something like that. You know, we are conditioned. We are essentially conditioned to expect that. So the purpose of a horror movie is really to terrify you and sort of kick you out of your complacency, to tell you something maybe about the human condition, where we are as a culture, you know, politically, socially, whatever. If that's the mission, then the way to do it is to shatter your conditioning. Because if you want to upset somebody, it's not just what you show, it's how you show it. It's how you decide to show it and how you decide to shatter that convention. And I think really the best horror movies are the ones that do that, that figure out a way to structurally undercut years and years of audience conditioning.
Yes. And I recall when an interview that I heard from Wes Craven, and I think they were discussing Last House on the Left, which is another one of those just pulverizing, terrifying experiences. And he said the best horror films, you know that you're not safe with the director. I mean, you know you're not on safe ground. Anything can happen at any time.
Exactly. You know, and again, it's just so funny. You know, a lot of people in the culture, you know, want to accuse, you know, film of, you know, of watching a film of being sort of a passive experience. But in the best horror movies, just like what Wes Craven indicated in that comment, it's really an active process. You know, you don't feel safe with the director, and suddenly, you know, you're glued to this thing. You know, what is going to happen? Suddenly all of the conceits, all of the preconditions, everything you came to expect in here is gone, and you're left there alone in the dark to see what's going to happen next. And that is an extremely powerful state of mind. It's an extremely suggestible frame of mind, and that's perfect because the director wants to then imprint on you, you know, again, what the message of the film is or whatever, or the scares, whatever. And it's just, you know, it can be incredibly powerful. I mean, Last House on the Left is just this bracing movie that kicks you back, you know, and it's, at times it's infuriating, but it's deliberately infuriating. There's this whole sequence in the film with these, like, dumbass cops who, like, run out of gas on the way to save the family, and they end up on a chicken truck, and they're just so dumb and so slow, and the movie keeps cutting to them like it's a dopey comedy. And, you know, I've heard people criticizing, you know, that whole aspect of the film, but, you know, that aspect of the film works because you're sitting there and your blood is boiling. Get a move on. Move. Get to where you're supposed to be. And at every attempt, Wes Craven said, you know, showing them, you know, bumbling and all this stuff. I mean, man, it works. You know, it's a crazy subplot in the movie, but, you know, in a horror movie that works. Your blood starts to boil. Why can't these people get it together? They're supposed to be helping. You know, that's what we expect.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a shattering of decorum. It's a shattering of tradition. We expect our policemen to be effective in the movies. We expect them to be heroic. At the very least, we expect they'll arrive at the crime scene after a call, you know, not that they're going to run out of gas and end up having to hitch a ride on a chicken truck. You know, so he's undercutting expectations, and the effect it has on the audience is powerful. It's just incredibly powerful.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about horror films in the particular decades in which they were made and how they're defined by the times in which they were made as well. But first of all, the experience of watching a horror film. Tonight, I'm going to go see Paranormal Activity 2 because I want to see it opening weekend at night with a full audience. That's exactly how that movie, I think, should be seen. experience for the first time. Tell me about that experience, because horror movies, maybe comedies are the closest to this, but such a communal experience, and the experience of the film is enhanced so much by watching it with an audience. Tell me about that, and as opposed to watching horror films alone at home, because I found the first Paranormal Activity was one of the most exhilarating movie-going experiences I've ever had, just because I liked the film very much. But the audience reaction was so wild. I mean, it was just a great evening for me. And then I watch it at home, and obviously the movie is set at home, and it's just as effective, but in a very different way for me.
Well, you get at something very interesting about horror movies being a sort of communal experience, and I can't really say it better than what John Carpenter did in this recent horror documentary, which I had the pleasure of participating in, Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue. He said, you know, these are campfire stories that the tribe tells. You know, the tribe is around them. The tribe is around the campfire listening to the stories. So in essence, in the movie theater, it's the tribe at the campfire, and our storyteller is the director who's put these images together, and they're flickering on the screen in front of us. But horror movies are really about cultural fears. They're about the fears of all of us. If it's an American fear, a film, it's reflecting some kind of fear in our culture, some political or social fear. And so when you get a bunch of people together on that, it's, you know, from the same culture and the same time period, it's speaking their language. You know, that's the great thing about film as a mass medium. You know, if it's made to reflect our times, and when the audience goes to see it, we all pick up on what those things are. We all pick up on those elements. We all subconsciously and consciously begin to realize what the movie is about. And as the tribe, we respond to that. You know, I think it's also very simple in the fact that, I mean, you share a roller coaster ride with many people too, and the kids screaming two seats back heightens your excitement, and when your excitement is heightened, that's transmitted to the guy two seats ahead of you, and the theater is the same thing. It can really be the same thing, is that excitement generated by the film goes to a person and another person and another person, and before you know it, everybody is really grooving on it. And you're right, it happens with a comedy too. You know, when somebody starts to laugh for the first time during a movie that you're watching in the theater, everybody else feels free to laugh too. And then the next round of laughter comes even louder, the next even louder. And horror movies, when they often become not in a bad way, but increasingly outrageous as they go. And, you know, an especially egregious scene like The Omen, where a plate glass decapitates somebody, you know, midway through the film. Just horrifying. But, you know, it's, you know, no one had seen anything really like that before, and the movie kept escalating and escalating. So each scare is sort of getting bigger and bigger, and the audience is feeling it get bigger and bigger, so that each moment comes and it seems more outrageous, and so the response becomes bigger. And, you know, before you know it, it's just, you know, it's just this huge snowball rolling downhill, and everybody's having a good time. And, you know, really, although this is the age of cell phones, so you do have interruptions in movies, but by and large, you don't have interruptions in movies other than cell phones. I mean, you just have the people around you talking and munching popcorn, you know, whereas, you know, when you're sitting to watch a movie on DVD, which I do love to do, it's wonderful, but, you know, if you have a little kid like me, you might have your baby monitor on and you're keeping one ear out. You know, you may be hungry, and there's sort of no, there's sort of nothing to stop you from saying, well, you know, I'll wait 2 hours and then go to a restaurant, which is what you might do in a theater. And so you say, well, you know, I'm going to go heat up a frozen pizza, you know.
Right.
Don't pause it, you know. Don't pause it, I'll be right back, you know. And you, so you miss a couple minutes. And so, you know, not only is there nobody else to feed on, but to feed off the energy of, so to speak, but you, there's really a different compact when you watch a movie on DVD. It's like,
The continuity of the experience is kind of compromised, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm going to watch this movie with the caveat that I understand the phone may ring and I might have to talk to someone for a half hour, or maybe hungry and take 15 minutes out to heat up something, and I might have to go make sure my baby can fall back asleep. You know, it is. It's a different set of circumstances that prevent you from experiencing the movie start to finish as a whole. And that means, and this is really a big thing that a lot of people don't consider, that means momentum is sacrificed. A lot of movies, especially a lot of horror movies, thrive on pace and momentum. You are so caught up in it that you don't necessarily have time to think about every ramification of every action, because you're just so caught up in that snowball rolling downhill. Now with the DVD, the snowball can, you know, take a left and stop for a couple minutes. And you know, while you're heating up the frozen pizza, you can say, you know, I don't think I would have really done that in that situation, because this, that, or the other thing. You know, you're suddenly allowed more time to reflect, you know, when you're watching it at home and can stop the movie. You know, and that does impact a work of art in a way. Not to say all movies depend on momentum or you can't stop them for a second, but it's something to consider. You know, and some people will watch their movies with the lights on. I mean, I still prefer to watch movies with all the lights off when I watch, but I also have to take notes. So there's usually, you know, one light on when I'm reviewing, and, you know, because, golly, when I go to the theater to review, I'm like scrawling, you know, on a piece of paper, and when I'm done, you know, my notes look like, you know, I'm a crazy man, I was drunk or something, you know, you know, because I can't see what I'm writing, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
there's also no reprieve when you watch it in a theater. If you watch The Last House on the Left in the theater, I mean, unless you walk out, there's no reprieve from that intensity. I mean, I think the Keystone Cop sequences kind of give you that in that film as well. I mean, we're going to leave the scenes in the woods for just a moment. You know, catch your breath. You're in the middle of hell, but let's take you out for a second before we delve back in.
Here's the first motion picture to offer to the daring a look into the final maddening space between life and death. The Last House on the Left. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Sights and sounds far beyond anything you've tested. The Last House on the Left. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie. Only a movie.
Take as only much as you can.
Only a movie.
Silence of the Lambs. I always refer to Silence of the Lambs as a horror film, and I think why people are hesitant to do that is because it's such kind of a prestigious movie. I mean, this is a movie that won, you know, however many, you know, the major Academy Award categories, the first of maybe three in history. How could it possibly be a horror movie, you know? But
that is such a good point.
Do you even think that that's a valuable distinction? I mean, categorizing it into genre, or does it limit it in a way?
You know, I think it limits it in some sense. I think what you said is just extremely insightful and smart, because it's the same thing with Seven. It was such a popular film. It's almost as if a film is really, really popular, you know, and critics seem to like it, then it seems like the culture wants to shy away from calling it a horror film because, oh, you know, Granny whoever doesn't like horror movies, and she liked Silence of the Lambs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be a horror movie. You know, 1 + 1 = 2, right? But it is a horror movie. It's just that, you know, horror movies have different levels and brands of appeal, and you know, part of the way that Silence of the Lambs was appealing was that it was part of this tidal wave of films and TV shows in the early 90s that were looking at the revolution sort of in forensic detective work. You know,
right.
how do we solve crimes using DNA, this and that, you know, that kind of, I mean, that was a big thing in the 90s. It's still a big thing now. And it's something that seems to appeal to, you know, everybody who watches, you know, A&E.
And all the top rated shows are procedurals, the Criminal
right.
Minds and the NCIS and on and on and on.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Court TV, too, you know, how are forensic used in the court? You know, that's something that grandma likes. So, you know, you see the forensic angle in Silence of the Lambs, and you can kind of step back and say, those people can say, oh, well, I like it because it's really a detective piece about how they catch the serial killer, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yes, but not only, you know. So, you know, it just depends on, I think it is kind of limiting. And for horror films of the 90s, I looked at a lot of these films like Single White Female, Cape Fear, The Hemp, and you know they're clearly horror movies. You know the villain is somebody who's like who I call an interloper, somebody who comes in and ruins the lives of supposedly respectable people. Though if you look in these stories, you know these supposedly respectable people have often brought it on themselves in some way, sometimes in little ways, sometimes in big ways. You know, and a lot of those films are categorized as thrillers, but I think they're horror films. I think the 1990s interloper, you know, the villain of The Temp, the villain of Single White Female, the villain of Cape Fear, they're all horror movie villains. They're like the development of the slasher into the more realistic, less artificial, serial killer, disturbed person mode, if that makes
yeah.
sense. You know,
and I'm so excited that you've done horror movies of the 1990s, because, I mean, I love your 70s and 80s volumes. Cape Fear is actually one of my favorite films, the Scorsese version. And I remember seeing that in the theater something like 8 or 9 times. I just could not get enough of it. And, I mean, it's when you have a real artist like Scorsese working in a genre that he's not necessarily accustomed to working in,
right.
he brings a whole new set of tools and themes to the genre. And you know, I really enjoy the Mitchum Gregory Peck Cape Fear. This one is infused with this kind of, well, what has preoccupied Scorsese throughout his career, the kind of the Catholic guilt and the religious overtones. And I'm dying to know what your take on his Cape Fear is.
Oh, I love Scorsese's Cape Fear, and I know this will be heresy to some. I think the original Cape Fear is a really, really good film, but I guess I see Scorsese's Cape Fear as my Cape Fear, because it's the one I experienced as new in the theater, as you say, and I saw it several times too.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was of that time. You know, it was of where we were. You know, when it was released, and there was, The wholesome American family isn't so wholesome anymore. There's infidelities. The incorruptible lawyer is corruptible. All these things. The seduction of innocence and youth. Which many see as something the culture was doing. You know, is present in the film. Robert De Niro's presence. I mean, he is literally a supernatural avenger in some sense. They never say he's supernatural. I mean, the way he speaks tongues, the way he survives burnings and beatings. I mean, he's more than human. He is a
yes.
boogeyman. You know, I really like it. And, you know, I like the bravado of Scorsese creating, you know, this as a horror film. And the wonderful and almost you know, Baroque technique of turning the film negative at times, just like flashing the negative image up at us, like of two hands intertwined with the wedding rings of the family. You know, I mean, that's a great visual, saying, you know, this dream of monogamy and the perfect marriage and the perfect American family has turned negative. I mean, that's a perfect way of saying it. It sounds obvious when I describe it that way, but it's really beautiful, and it's something that, coming from not strictly a horror background, I think Scorsese did that maybe a horror background filmmaker wouldn't have done that. He would have found another way to do it, but he wouldn't have used that particular tool. And, you know, and I love how he does that. You know, that he just has the bravery and bravado to do something that seems simple, but in fact, you know, is a really great technique to tell us, you know, this is flipped. This isn't what it's supposed to be. It's the negative of that. It's the opposite of that. You know, of what the previous film was. It almost works, you know, in an intertextual level with the original film.
And how it deals with morality, how it expresses issues of morality, and how man kind of descends into violence. And the end of the film when they're stoning each other, you know, and the last image of Nolte where he's squatting on the lakefront like a primate. There's just so much to savor in that movie for me. It's one of my favorites.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, one of the things that I certainly saw, you know, with the horror films of the 90s was that one of the things they were really, really grappling with was the idea that, you know, more than ever, it seemed like we were in a morally relative culture. And, you know, what are all the things that entails? You know, to me, that movie is very much about that. You know, Robert De Niro was wrong. Something wrong was done to him, yet he is also a bad man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's morally relative. It asks you to hold those two thoughts in your head at the same time and not reconcile them. That he is both wrong and wronged. And I think that's very interesting. I just think it's very interesting. And there are a lot of the horror films of the 90s that are like that. Another one that I mentioned is Single White Female, which is very much that way. The character played by Jennifer Jason Leigh is clearly psycho and has boundary issues. But if you look at the film, it's also clear that Bridget Fonda's character sort of invites her in. She kind of says, "Oh, I never had a sister. Let me try on your earrings. Let me do this." You know, she's the one who breaks the sort of roommate boundaries first, and then the other character, I think her name was Hedra, Jennifer Jason Leigh's character. You know, then she comes back and breaks them even more. That's why I said there's always what I find so interesting about these interloper films of the 90s, like Cape Fear and The Temp and Single White Female, and there are other titles I can't remember, but is it this idea that the people who are basically attacked by these interlopers play some role in what happens to them. Either they've cheated on a spouse, that they've acted immorally or unethically on the job. They've done something that has brought this on themselves. They've crossed the boundary they shouldn't, and this is the blowback that comes to it. But we're still asked to consider those people who did those wrongs as the protagonists of the film. You know,
mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting because it becomes a matter of scope. And this is where the 90s was, I mean, it really came down to this. I mean, you know, you look at Bill Clinton and the presidency of Bill Clinton. He was either this great president who got us out of a recession and delivered us into peace and prosperity and great economic boom times, or he was this cheating big creep, as Monica Lewinsky called him, who cheated on his wife and, you know, was impeached by the Republicans for his bad personal behavior, or the truth, he was both.
Yes.
He was both of those things simultaneously, and we had to grapple with that relativism. Can I say on one hand, my gosh, what a great job he did. What a really sturdy hand he was at the economy and everything else. We really had good years in the last half of the 90s in particular, but we also had all this nonsense that he put us through. And, you know, let's not, you know, candy coat that. He did put us through it, you know. He knew he had enemies on every side waiting to nail him the moment he did something wrong, and he still did something wrong. I mean, the reaction, of course, was wrong. I always say it was a witch hunt, but he gave them the ammunition for the witch hunt.
Right.
You know?
What's your connection with this fellow?
I was his lawyer.
What did you say? I put some in a rifle.
What was he in prison for?
No, really. What did you do?
Have you been following us?
small town is the way you turn. I guess we're going to run into each other.
Dad, you should have just punched him out.
Yeah, you know how to fight, Larry. Didn't you do that for a living?
This guy, he threatened you?
He's clever.
So that the law can't touch him.
You have a daughter around 16?
16? What?
We'll be hearing from the Ethics Committee.
We got this freaking psychopath in our faces. I mean, who knows what's true and what isn't?
I'm just losing my mind here. I called the vet, and then he died.
I told you not to let him out.
Get him! Let him out! Let him out!
It would be unethical of me to advise a business to take the law into his own hands.
But back to Scorsese and the question of morality, I think that that's the main difference between the two Cape Fears, is what you just articulated. The line between good and evil is compromised. It's blurred in a way. And
right.
I'm interested in how the great horror films view morality, because there's a tendency in a lot of films that you watch where you're told exactly what to feel,
right.
Exactly the moral stance that the movie's taking. Just watching Kubrick films lately, Kubrick was famous for not doing that. I mean, a movie like Full Metal Jacket doesn't have a single reaction shot until 30 minutes into it. You're not programmed to know what to feel at that time. How does that characterize the great horror films in your view?
Well, I think most of the great horror films actually do boast a sense of morality, but how they do it is not the obvious way. They don't program you. They don't spoon-feed you. They tell you through their choice of techniques what the filmmaker is trying to say. Not that you must agree with it, but what they're trying to say. And for instance, one of my favorite examples of this is Last House on the Left,
mm-hmm.
Wes Craven's original, which was decried far and wide as, you know, perverted and, you know, just this, you know, violent, ugly film. Well, hold on a minute. Not exactly. Not exactly. Because what that film says is essentially that violence is committed upon a family by these terrible criminals. And at the end of the film, the parents visit that evil, that violence, as brutally on the criminals as it was visited upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie's way of saying that this is bad is the final freeze frame, where you see the bloody reaction shot of this exhausted family. They're alive, but their house is covered in blood. Their daughter is still dead. The violence has solved nothing. And to underline that, on the soundtrack, we have this song with the words about the road leads to nowhere, the castle stays the same. And what that is saying is that generation after generation, we keep having this immense violence. Even in the peace and love generation, we have this violence, this insatiable need for violence. And so the film is actually anti-violence. And in fact, it is much more anti-violence than The Virgin Spring, upon which it is based, directed by Ingmar Bergman. Now, Bergman's film gives you Max von Sydow as the father, and he delivers the brutal violence upon the people who killed his daughter. But he looks heavenward and says, God, why have you done this to me? And to prove that God exists, and I guess tacitly agrees with his decision to kill the unwashed herdsman who raped and murdered his daughter, a bubbling spring comes up and gives him faith. This is religious validation of violence, folks. That is
mm-hmm.
much worse than anything in Last House on the Left. Another example, Death Wish. Death Wish is all about a guy cleaning up the jungles of New York, Charles Bronson, who's going to go out and just shoot people. I mean, yes, he was wrong, but he's just shooting people. He's just killing
mm-hmm.
people. He's taking the law into his own hands. And that film is lauded and popular, whereas a film like Last House on the Left, which is decidedly anti-violence, is decried as being violent when it's about violence, when it's really seriously about violence and the violence we do in our culture. You know,
yeah.
So there is a stance. There's a very deliberate stance in Last House on the Left, and it's a very, you know, rarefied moral stance. It's saying that violence is wrong. You've seen a lot of violence here. What does it achieve, folks? Nothing.
Mm.
The road leads to nowhere. The castle stays the same. I mean, it couldn't be any more clear than that in terms of how Wes Craven uses film techniques from the soundtrack to the final freeze frame to show you what he wants to tell you about violence in America and our culture. But everybody misperceived it. Well, because this movie has such violent acts, it must be a terrible, violent movie that is depraved, which isn't the case.
Yeah.
I mean, there are moments in the film where you see the humanity of those rapists. I mean, just briefly, just very briefly, after they rape Mary, there's a look on their face of disgust when they realize what they are and what they've done to another human being. It lasts only a moment, and then they're back to being their despicable selves. But the film has shades, you know, of subtlety. It has this nuance. It has this idea that violence doesn't change anything for the better, whereas the mainstream films of the time, like Death Wish, just don't have that. And where even,
yeah,
you know, a great artist like Ingmar Bergman was willing to write off that violence, you know, by saying God tacitly approves it. You know, here's the bubbling spring. You know, build a church for me here. You know, that's what the Virgin Spring says. And nobody looks at that and says, that's corrupt. That's so corrupt. You're saying you can kill in the name of God and God will approve. My God, is that a message you want to going out to people who are threatening, you know, abortion clinics or whatever, you know what I mean? Or,
yes,
you know,
yeah,
you don't want that message going out, that it's okay to kill in the name of God, because who can judge what God is really saying? You know, you want some wacko judging in his head? You know, so Bergman's film actually kind of approves of that point of view. And Last House on the Left, this secular, you know, atheist vision of it, says, no, listen, this does not change anything. So, anyway,
and I think it also goes back to what we were talking about with the perception of Silence of the Lambs compared to other kinds of serial killer movies, and this view that a lot of people have that horror is a disreputable kind of genre.
Right.
It's horror if it feels, you know, underground, if it feels disreputable in some way. Because when you brought up the moral themes of Last House on the Left, my mind went to Eastwood's Unforgiven, which I think deals with the uselessness of violence in a similar way, and vengeance and that kind of thing. And yet Unforgiven is so incredibly acclaimed, and Last House on the Left is obviously a bird of a different color for people.
Right, right. Well, you know, the horror films are uncomfortable, and there's this line to where they become disreputable because they are uncomfortable, because they tell us things that other movies aren't going to tell us flat out. I mean, I remember very specifically feeling this in the mid-1980s when there was a lot of moral majority complaint about horror films. But at the same token, we had the A-Team on television every week where people were shooting at each other and cars were flying over and turning over, and nobody was ever getting hurt, even though machine guns were firing and flamethrowers were flying. And at the same token, in the culture, we had Rambo, who was putting arrows through the heads of communists, you know, someone whose ideology he disagreed with. And that was deemed okay. That was deemed okay. This kind of stuff was all deemed okay. Well, that's patriotic. He, you know, he's killing a commie for the United States. Or, well, you know, the A-Team is just fun. It's just almost fun. And I'm not saying either of those things are bad, but I'm saying that where the horror films really tend to be about violence, they take the concept of violence in our culture and really say something about it. They're really about the violence and what that violence does to people. Those are the films that are then derided as being sort of superficially and unnecessarily violent, when actually the opposite is true. It's like those critics are projecting, you know? Like all the guys, I mean, recently we've seen it too, and it's just hysterical. All the critics who fall over themselves, the Christian critics who fall over themselves to hate the Saw movies, are the first ones lauding Passion of the Christ. Well, you tell me which one is more violent.
Yeah.
You know, you tell me which one, you know, has a secret agenda, you know, and it's not about violence, right? You know?
Absolutely.
You know, it's just very interesting how this debate is framed in the culture. You know, films that are, you know, genuinely about what violence does to people and how it impacts lives are derided, whereas, you can't take a joke? Look, you know, 200 people die in Live Free and Die Hard. Hey, you know, what? You can't, no, look, enjoy Live Free and Die Hard. It's an adventure, or Lethal Weapon, or whatever. But don't say that the violence in those films is okay, but it's not okay in the horror movies that honestly countenance those ideas and try to grapple with them. Not always successfully. Of course not. Some movies do not always successfully do that. I'm still deeply on the fence about the original I Spit on Your Grave. I watched that with my wife, and that's a film where a woman is raped and brutally and terrorized, and she is then, she takes up the mantle of revenge and takes out on her her rapist. She brutally kills them all. Now, my wife said she thought there was a moral component and validity to that story, but I didn't see the that sort of thing that I saw in Last House on the Left. To me, that was just a story of saying, well, you've hurt me, and now I shall hurt you, eye for an eye. I didn't see something there. You know, it was a different message about violence, I guess.
Is that the difference between a horror film and an exploitation film for you?
I generally don't make that distinction. I really don't.
Okay.
I really don't. It's really hard to say what an exploitation film is. In some sense, because you could look at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and say, well, that's an exploitation film. Just look at that title. I mean, you know what you're going to get from the title. Or Last House on the Left, you know, which people would call an exploitation film. You know, I call them great horror movies. Now, a lot of people love I Spit on Your Grave, and I'm open to seeing, you know, that point of view. I know it's a favorite of many, but I don't see the more noble side of that. And maybe that's my blinders or my bias as a film critic. You know, I don't see what the more noble point of that is. Whereas, like, I think the really great horror films like Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, those movies tend to have that sort of ennobling moral stance where you see what the critic is trying to say. And it's usually a criticism of us and how we live now. I don't see that criticism of us and how we live now in I Spit on Your Grave. Now, the last time I saw it was 10 years ago, and I've learned a lot as a critic since then, so maybe I owe myself the chance to watch it again and see if I do see that. And I'd love to hear if anybody does see that in the film. You know, I'm always open to that. I one of the things I love to do is to sort of reconsider films, especially, you know, I see my career as a critic as one in which I'm, you know, sort of constantly gaining education. So maybe I wouldn't look at the film today as I did in the year 2000. But you know, that's my feeling, is that, you know, I Spit on Your Grave isn't that high-minded kind of thing as what Wes Craven was doing in Last House on the Left. Again, could be wrong.
Welcome to a night of total terror. A bizarre adventure in fear. An experience in shock more shattering than your strangest nightmare. Night of the Living Dead. A night with the dead who cannot die. A night of total terror. Night of the Living Dead.
Romero is a guy that I've enjoyed his films outside of the Dead series too, especially a movie like Martin. For the life of me, I can't imagine why they haven't remade that now, as hot as vampires are right now. But and they're remaking everything. So, but you know, it also goes back to Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which I think is a highly successful series of films at illuminating where we are in the world at that time. It seems like a very malleable kind of premise that they can apply to all kinds of different situations. How does Romero do that with the Dead films, do you think? Because he's quite obviously structured it as social commentary. I mean, that's been his modus operandi throughout this series. Where do you think the greatest successes in that series are in illuminating those points of where we are as a nation, as a people?
Well, I think the Dead films are very interesting, and they're all products of their time, so they all tell us different things. I mean, I think Night of the Living Dead is an amazing, it's a masterpiece of horror, there's no doubt about it, and the context is a lot about what we talked about, Vietnam, but it is also about the racial angle you spoke of, you know, the idea of, well, you put the rednecks with the guns in charge and tell them to shoot people in the head. Do you really want to do that? is that really a good idea? No, it's not, because you know they have a very parochial view of, you know, who real Americans are and who real Americans aren't. And if they have a gun, they're going to be they're going to be executing that point of view from a trigger. So you don't want that. So there is a racial angle to that. Now, Dawn of the Dead, I happen to like even better than Night of the Living Dead. I know both films are masterpieces, but the late 70s Dawn of the Dead, you know, just being such a dead-on comment on, you know, the consumer culture of the late 1970s. I mean, this it came out after President Carter's famous crisis of confidence speech, in which he spoke about a plague. He didn't actually say a plague, but it was essentially saying there was a plague infecting Americans. And that plague was judging yourself and others not by what you do, but by what you have, and the glorification of owning things. I mean, this is actually, you know, pretty much what he said. I mean, it's astonishing to hear a president speak to a nation in such a clear-cut, unsoundbite-ish kind of way. But I mean, you know, that's what he said, and what Dawn of the Dead depicts with its central setting of the shopping mall, you know, is a comment on our consumer culture. On, you know, the zombies want to get in. You know, they're pounding down the doors to get in. There are things in that mall that they want. And we know from Romero that, you know, the zombies are us. That was his big thing through the middle passages of those films. I think then that, you know, to be brutally honest, I don't think Day of the Dead captured the 80s culture as well as Night of the Living Dead captured the 60s or Dawn of the Dead captured the 70s. I like Day of the Dead, but I actually feel that another film that came out the same year, Dan O'Bannon's Return of the Living Dead, which looked into the punk aesthetic and the death culture of America, the death culture in music, the death culture in movies, the nuclear culture, the apocalypse mentality of the 80s, I actually think that got at the 80s more cannily than what Romero did in Day of the Dead, and I realize some people see that as sacrilege. I'm not saying Romero's Day of the Dead isn't good. I'm just saying that I think Return of the Living Dead captured the vibe much more clearly and powerfully than Day of the Dead did. Okay, then we skip several years, and we're post 9/11 to Land of the Dead, and I happen to like that film. I know a lot of people really don't like it. I think, though, it very powerfully does get at the 9/11 context, which he probably doesn't get as much credit for that film because so much of the 2000s is the post 9/11 context. We see 9/11, you know, as the motivating factor for so many horror films, and there's nothing wrong with that. It was the biggest factor in our lives, really, in all of our lives, in America's life for such a long time, and horror movies obsessed on it. And what we have in Land of the Dead is the idea of a rich man sort of getting what he needs from the crisis, from the zombie crisis, and sort of becoming, you know, the leader of this community, and he only lets in the people he wants, you know, the haves and the have-mores, so to speak. You know, and so you know, it's very much a reflection on, you know, the Bush administration and how it tried to inject 9/11 and patriotism into everything that happened afterwards. You know, if you don't do this, you're not a patriotic American. If you don't do this, you know, every angle, you know, it was all politicking all the time, and 9/11 was the bludgeon with which he hit his enemies, very successfully, I might add. I mean, I remember, you know, just being astonished that a Vietnam veteran in Georgia, Max Cleland, who'd lost three limbs fighting for America in Vietnam, was brandished by his Republican enemy as being linked to Osama bin Laden. I mean, he actually morphed into Osama bin Laden in a television ad because he didn't support, at one point in the whole deliberative process, the development of the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, that is astonishing. And people bought it. Cleveland lost. I mean, the man who gave three of his limbs to protect this country, and he's equated with a mass murderer. But that shows you where we were in 9/11. We were afraid. We were very afraid, clearly. So, you know, I think there's a lot of that in Land of the Dead. And it may take that entry in the Dead series several more years to kind of gain acceptance, I think. I don't think that either that or we're just so divided and we'll be perpetually divided that people won't see it and they just won't like that entry.
I like Land of the Dead, too, very much. I read your reviews of the last two entries as well. And I think you, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you weren't crazy about Diary of the Dead, but you found value in Survival of the Dead.
Yeah, I you know, Diary of the Dead, I was very disappointed with because instead of sort of trailblazing, I felt that Romero was following the pack. You know, we'd had some very good experiential sort of first-person through-the-camera horror movies and the likes of The Blair Witch Project and also Cloverfield, which I liked very much, and also Wreck, which is fantastic. Oh, what a great film Wreck is. And, you know, I just felt like Romero was following the curve, but I never felt that he really obeyed the rules of that format. He would cut into tracking shots. He would, you know, through the camera and do all these things that sort of negated the value of that first-person point of view. So I was very disappointed with that. I felt like it was almost amateurish. And I was prepared, quite frankly, not to like Survival of the Dead because I heard so many bad things about it. But, again, Romero really is just, master at weaving timely social commentary, into his films. And in Survival of the Dead, basically he has an exile character convince representatives of the U.S. military to go in and solve his problem in his home country. And really, I mean, it's blatant. That's what the Iraqi exile Ahmad Chalabi did inside the U.S. government. You know, he told them, you know, we'd be treated as liberators. We have to go to Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein. Go solve our problem over there. You know, he made it look like something we needed to do when it was something he wanted to do. And that is very much the core current of that film. And so, I mean, you know, perfect social commentary, I think, on these times. You know, I think the film also gets at the division we're experiencing in our country now, over the way we perceive to do things. I mean, we have the liberals and the conservatives. We have the red states and the blue states, and never the twain shall meet, you know. And, we're perpetually positioned against each other because that's what the political parties want. That's how they raise money. And, that's what you have in the film. You have Muldoon and O'Flynn, I guess their names are. And, you know, they're just diametrically opposed in their positions, and they want the other one to admit that they're wrong. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, I won't kill you if you admit that I'm right. I mean, a lot of times that seems to be what it's gotten to if you've watched political debates, literally.
Absolutely.
Romero is very much talking about that. I think this is Romero at his most exasperated. I wrote in the review again of that documentary, Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue, where he said, what's it going to take to change? What are we going to do to change? We keep making the same mistakes over and over again. 9/11 is Vietnam. Iraq is Vietnam all over again, you know, but we do it anyway. You know, he just seems exasperated because we can't seem to change. We can't seem to get out of this rut of violence and foreign wars and this just, we're not focusing on the big issues. You know, we're arguing over, you know, is the minimum wage constitutional? Yeah. We're arguing over nonsense while the Titanic sinks. You know, we're rearranging the chairs. You know, meanwhile we've got, you know, global warming and we've got, you know, 65 million Americans without health care. We've got huge issues, but instead of honestly trying to deal with them, we're dealing with these stupid little things. You know, we're dealing with these stupid little side arguments that call up our pre-existing ideologies and distract us from what's really important.
Yeah,
and
they divert
us
from the big picture. Yeah,
they do, and
that's the political landscape now. It has been for some time.
And that's what Survival of the Dead is really all about. It's a Western about the Western world, I said in my review, and I really think that's true. I think he's saying, you know what, America, you've lived with this myth of the Western for a long time, of the cowboy who rides into town and cleans it up and goes on, and he's kind of saying, you guys need to outgrow cowboys. Outgrow cowboys, let's start dealing with our problems, you know, because this monomyth of the cowboy, of the superhero who rides in and cleans everything up, it's not viable anymore. It's not happening. It's not fixing this country. You know, we've had so much cowboy rhetoric, you know, in this decade, and I mentioned some of those in my review, you know, smoke Osama bin Laden out of his caves, and we're going to get him dead or alive, you know. We love our cowboys, don't we? We love those cowboys. But what are the cowboys solving? That's the question. How long are we going to let the nation be dictated to by these cowboys? And so I actually like Survival of the Dead. I don't think it's in any way as good as Dawn of the Dead or Night of the Living Dead, but I do think it's a return to form after Diary of the Dead.
So. Something that interests me, because when you deal with someone like Romero or Craven or Toby Hooper or Carpenter, people that have worked in this genre throughout their careers, and they've made kind of variations on a theme. What really interests me is how their work matures or doesn't mature as they get older.
Right.
I mean, we talk about this with all creative talents, even actors. When we're talking about a great like De Niro, we're saying, where is his next Taxi Driver? You know, where's
right.
that fire in the belly? And it has to be a question of maybe age, maybe being hungrier when you're younger. You know, that might be too reductive, but how do you see their maturation in terms of what age gives them, what kind of different perspectives that age gives some of these filmmakers in their ongoing series and explorations in the horror genre?
Well, I felt it was wonderful to see George Romero dealing with characters who weren't teenagers in Survival of the Dead, who had their own unique history and their sort of their own sense of selves and where they came from. You know, that O'Flynn and Muldoon, these men in their 60s, white men in their 60s, were, you know, deciding the fate of the world. I thought that was interesting and good, rather than, you know, let's not just have teenagers, you know, running around. I thought that was interesting. I thought, I don't know, well, I mean, Carpenter's always been good about his mix of characters, but I thought he stumbled a little bit in Diary of the Dead, you know, just having all teenagers be the center of it. I liked that he sort of went for a more mature perspective. Romero is working more often, which I think is good. You know, I think the book is still out on how those films are going to hold up over the decades. In terms of Carpenter, I will say this. You underestimate John Carpenter at your own risk, and I speak from personal experience. I wrote the films of John Carpenter in 1998, I guess. It came out in 2000,
mm-hmm.
and I was sort of very down on his work from the 1990s. I mean, I love Carpenter. I admire the hell out of him. I think he's fantastic. I really appreciate his artistry. But, I found much to quibble with in Vampires and In the Mouth of Madness and Village of the Damned and stuff. Well, I've gone back. You know, I just wrote horror films of the 90s this past year. And I thought, well, it's been 10 years since I wrote that book or thereabouts. And I owe it to myself to not only watch those films again, but to write new reviews, because I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago, and maybe I will feel
mm-hmm.
differently. And boy, did I. You know, a decade worth of the Underworld films will cure you of your misperception that John Carpenter somehow passed it or not at the top of his form directing, you know, horror action films. That is really true. That is really true. I liked Vampires much better with 10 years distance. I've always liked Ghosts of Mars. I still do. I think it really holds up, and I know that'll surprise a lot of people, but I think it's really good. I still have trouble with Village of the Damned, but I like In the Mouth of Madness more. You know, I think, you know, somebody, a blogger who has a blog, Musings of Sci-Fi Fanatic, he's a great blogger, and he wrote during a John Carpenter retrospective on my blog a couple weeks ago, he said, critical hatred plus time, you know, and, you know, guarantees a Carpenter classic. And I think that's true. Carpenter's classicism, in terms of his visual presentation, you know, pretty much guarantees that, you know, after 10 years, 15 years, his films always rise to the pack of each decade. It's really amazing. And you can't quite recognize how good they are in the moment. But you go back, I mean, I watched something like 350 films from the 1990s. You know, and when you're getting into stuff like Die Hard, Dracula, and Ice Cream Man, that's not fair because those are like really bottom of the barrel ones. But even when you're getting into the mainstream regular stuff, which you think should be good, like Hellraiser 3 or Sleepwalkers or things like that, which you think, hey, these were top of the line horror movies at the time, they're terrible. They are terrible. They are terrible. They are absolutely awful. You know, John Carpenter's stuff, they're distinctly his. They are distinctly his. You look at his films and you look at what the failures are, they are the failures of one man, not the failure of a committee. They're not the failure of a studio that test screened and focus grouped the hell out of the movie. They're his individual quirks. And once you accept that, he's making the movies he wants in the way he wants, you can see the value of them. So let me tell you, you underestimate Carpenter at your own risk. You really do. You really do, because I did. If I could do it all over again, I'd go back in time to when I wrote films of John Carpenter, and I'd write a more positive review of Vampires and a more positive review of In the Mouth of Madness. And even though I don't think Village of the Damned is a particularly good film, I would also write a better review of that. And fortunately, horror films of the 90s gave me the chance to go back and tweak and rewrite and do those things that I wanted to do. So at least I can correct my mistakes no matter how belatedly, you know.
Do you think that, I mean, Carpenter obviously is most acclaimed for Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Is it difficult to see, and also The Thing is just one of the great
right.
movies.
Is
oh, it yes. difficult to when you have such a great early success as that, are you always measuring their returns to that genre against that, against their greatest success? Is that an unfair kind of practice?
I think it is unfair, and I think it is what I did when I wrote the films of John Carpenter back in the late 90s. I think I thought, okay, look, Halloween. Well, first, Dark Star, brilliant. Assault on Precinct 13, brilliant. Halloween,
mm-hmm.
brilliant. The Fog, brilliant. The Thing, greatest horror film of the 1980s, you know. And then you just keep going. You get Escape from New York, great dystopian thriller, commentary on, you know, the urban blight of the 70s, fantastic. That was before The Thing. Then, you know, you can go from one to the other, and they're all great. And then you do get around to the 90s, and you think, well, wait a minute. Is Vampires that good? And maybe if you measure Vampire, you do measure Vampires against Halloween, you say, no, it's not quite that good. But trust me, you measure Vampires against its 349 brethrens in the 1990s, you say, hey, that's a three-and-a-half-star movie there, buddy.
Yeah.
You know, so it probably isn't really fair, because a filmmaker can't stay the same as times change. They're going to grow too. I mean, the good filmmakers will stick to their core identities and do meditation sort of on a theme, as you talked about. And Carpenter does do that. I mean, we've seen him do Rio Bravo as Assault on Precinct 13, as Prince of Darkness, and in 2001 as Ghosts of Mars. So he's still doing that. You know, we've seen him remake Escape from New York basically as a political satire in Escape from L.A. You know, he very much sticks to the core of who he is, but he's not the same person. You know, he made a great film in Halloween, but I'm not sure that if John Carpenter today would see the script for Halloween and say, I need to make that movie. You know,
yes.
Things are different. He was at the start of his career, and that was the opportunity that came, and my God, he shot it out of the park. You know, he hit it out of the park. He was just, you know, fantastic, great movie. Today, I don't know if that would interest him. He's, you know, and that's okay. You know, his career is in a different place, and he's in a different place. So you do have to kind of consider that, I think. You have to consider, you know, their personal aesthetic, you know, where they are, where they've been. You know, I don't know that it would interest him. I mean, he turned down Halloween H2O, which certainly
mm-hmm.
would have benefited from his sense of classicism, from his sense of blocking and composure of, you know, from his composition of shots. I mean, it certainly would have benefited from him. But he didn't do it because he'd been there. You know, if he'd made Halloween H2O, he probably would have knocked that one out of the park, too, and everyone would have been talking about that as his comeback film. But I don't
right.
know that he would have wanted Halloween H2O to be his comeback film. You know, it's very interesting. It's just very interesting. I respect the hell out of Carpenter. I really do, and I just think that I think he's going to really be remembered as a great director, as opposed to 10 years ago, I think, myself, I fell into this sort of
what happened to John Carpenter kind of mentality.
Yeah, hey, he's made
yeah.
a couple of bombs, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is viable anymore. I really don't.
But what interests me, looking at your list of you know the greatest horror films of the 80s, is that your top two favorite horror films both deal in some way with mutation.
Oh, so it was The Thing and Altered States? Is that what I have?
I think wasn't The Fly your second?
Oh, The Thing and The Fly.
Number
That's
three.
Right. Yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the Thing gets very much at a sense of interpersonal chaos. I mean, in some sense. I mean, it's not strictly, you know, the savage cinema, but it is a variation of it in a sense. You know, it's about a very kind of personal apocalypse where there's nobody you can trust. There's nobody to believe in. You know, faith is a hard thing to come by these days, as MacReady says in the film, Kurt Russell. And you kind of have to make it under your own auspices. And the final thing is, the best you can do maybe is fight it to a standstill. You're not going to beat the bad thing. You're just going to fight it to a standstill. I do think that body issues and mutation. That's a very interesting aspect of 80s culture, because the 1980s was the sort of perfect culture. Do you remember that movie Perfect with Jamie Lee Curtis and John Travolta?
Yes.
Not a very good movie, but it sort of captured all of the aerobic craze of the 1980s. We had Olivia Newton-John, Let's Get Physical, I remember, with her headband dancing around. We had the Jane Fonda aerobics tape. There really became this obsession, movies like Flashdance, what have you, with physicality in the 80s. That, if you're beautiful, if you look beautiful, you are beautiful, inside too. Look great, look your best, That was really a movement in the 80s. And then the back movement, the sort of blowback against it, we saw in all the horror films of the time, and AIDS certainly played a role in this, or it was known as, some people thought it was a gay disease at first, we had this epidemic, but we had that countered with, have a beautiful body and have sex with who you want, kind of thing. And the horror movies had this blowback against that. I mean, we had American Werewolf in London, which was about mutation, which killed a love affair. We had The Howling, which was about mutation, but which the monster somehow believed it made them better, by becoming the monster. It was some sort of self-help kind of thing. They realized their monstrous potential, I guess. We had The Thing, we had The Fly, we had Altered States. We had all these movies dealing with mutation, the changing of form in the 1980s. And I think that was a response to all the films saying, you have to be beautiful, you have to be fit, you got to do your Jane Fonda and listen to Olivia Newton-John and, be that person. And that's what it means to be an American. And then suddenly.
And Cronenberg has always been preoccupied with that kind of mutation. Also how technology, when he throws technology into the mix, how that's changing us. And
yeah.
we're becoming one with technology in a way that could be terrifying.
right. Well, you look at Videodrome and The Fly, and those kind of films where we're sort of mutating into the machine, which is very interesting too. And I wonder if you look at the early 1980s, and that was sort of a revolution in the era of the home computer. I remember William Shatner and Isaac Asimov selling, Commodore VIC-20s kind of thing. And it's not a chicken in every pot, it's a computer in every house. And, what's that going to do to people? What is that going to mean, having a computer in every house? What does that do? What does having a VCR in every house do? If you watch too much TV, are you going to grow a slot in your stomach, to put the VHS tape in? that's an exaggeration,
yeah.
But not really an exaggeration. We were... That was sort of the new frontier at that point, computers and VCRs. I mean, those were the tools that made a huge difference in how we live in the 1980s. So it's only natural that horror movies would sort of come to obsess on them. And if you jump forward to the 1990s, of course, you start to look at like CD-ROM games and the internet as being the fear in a lot of horror films like Brain Scan. We had virtual reality and other technology, which everyone thought was going to happen, like Lawnmower Man and, what else? I guess Demolition Man, that wasn't really a horror movie. But, there were all these, all of these technological bugaboos, science run amok coming out. I guess we were also afraid, of the Human Genome Project, which started in the 90s. And, the idea of sort of DNA and genetics unbound in films like Jurassic Park and such, where we could create monsters. So, technology is always a really great fear for horror movies to exploit. And I guess if you go to the 2000s, we have Cyber Stalkers and Swim Fan, and we have...
We have Catfish now, which I hear is a horrifying movie, Catfish, that deals with social networking and how that I'm sure we're going to have a run of horror films dealing with social networking coming soon. once we understand what the implications are.
Right. No, and I cannot wait for that. I look forward to like 20 years from now when I'm writing the book of this decade's horror film saying, oh, remember the Facebook, huh? but yeah, maybe if you look at the 2000s, like fear.com, you know, and movies like that, oh, we're afraid of the internet, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. There's horror movies are always sort of that, you know, it's very interesting that they often point, they're often very progressive, and they say, you know, these are the things that are wrong in our culture, you know, you can make them better. But they also often say, put on the brakes, what is this? We don't know what this is. Let's be a little bit afraid of it. You know, it's a very interesting dynamic, I think, that horror movies can simultaneously be bastions of traditionalism and progressive markers of, you know, the edge of cultural acceptance, I guess.